We listened to your lecture yesterday, and you were focused mostly on the sheep, yeah, and their psychology, and their lost, and like the lost folklore of transhuman, the movement of sheep from low to higher pastures, that it became like more of a folklore, you know, like the performance for the tourists. I really liked your statement that if we can find sheep interesting, then even the most terrible performance is worth our attention. Is this sheep explication for you like some kind of a new method of perceiving theater? This would be my first question.
Yes, for me, the movement of the sheep offer me as the person watching and participating with the sheep a number of possibilities. Certainly not all possibilities, but for me they extend the range of practical possibilities. They extend the range of mental possibilities, of metaphysical possibilities. They therefore for me expand the repertoire, which is very important coming from a literary tradition in England where Shakespeare is dominant, where a particular kind of closing down of the theatrical repertoire is very apparent to anybody in Europe. A literary tradition holds control. So my interest in the sheep is partly a corrective, a change to this dominant order of the word. But in talking about the sheep, I realize that, of course, their practices have already been recorded by those writers who I'm interested in. So it would be silly for me to say this is disconnecting from the literary tradition. And the example I choose is the first example in Western dramaturgy, Oedipus Rex by Sophocles, where, of course, Sophocles understands in his rural hinterland, the rural landscape of Greece, what the movement of these sheep means. The positioning of the shepherds in Oedipus Rex, absolutely critical to the drama of Oedipus Rex, the changing of a baby from one hand of a shepherd to another in a forest that begins the problem for Thebes. So in my discussion of sheep, I'm looking for noticing, acknowledging the possibilities they offer, at the same time as expanding the way that we read our theatrical tradition of texts.
You were mentioning this Oedipus Rex Sophocles, that also had been seriously connected with shepherds, and in the end Oedipus blames them for not killing him. Is then Oedipus as an aristocratic person impatient, you know, because you talked a lot about patience and democracy?
Yes, it is Oedipus's natural right to be impatient, and indeed the time of our politics now can be divided perhaps into two. That is, those regimes which have patience and those regimes which do not have patience. Now in Slovenia at the moment you might think of the culture as being one with a degree of patience or a degree of impatience. I would suggest from the people who were listening to me talk last night that this audience had a lot of patience listening to an Englishman talking in the way I was. And I think this is because within your culture you do have a patience with serious ideas, far more patience than we perhaps have in England with these sorts of ideas. Perhaps this is a slightly philosophical feeling within the audience. So having said this, I do agree with you that Oedipus is an example of an impatient ruler, and what occurs in Oedipus is partly to do with the logic of what happens to such an impatience. What is incredible in the play is the way that he does not recognize, which is why it is tragic, his impatience. And even at the end, he is blaming the very people who showed protection towards him, the shepherds, for their inability to acknowledge and recognize that he should have been killed. Of course, it's impossible for a shepherd who is defined by patience defined by care to kill a baby, whether they like it or not. And Oedipus's failure is his failure not to understand this by the end of the play. It has a quality of Lear, King Lear, about it, which is why I suppose we jump hundreds of years from Oedipus to King Lear as examples of this kind of tragic hubris. I'm not really interested in hubris, it's a very cliched idea, but I do think your suggestion that Oedipus is an impatient figure allows us to explore a relationship, for instance, between regimes of waiting and inability to wait. And it seems to me that this is a place that we could think more sensitively about the shape of our politics, as opposed perhaps to simple formal questions of our politics. By shape, I really mean the shape that the sheep take in forming a patient group.
My next question would be, as your fascination with animals is obvious, but this fascination is not very common in the field of theater. In the field of theater is quite peculiar, you know. So I was wondering, as I know you also theoretically dealt with Società Raffaello Sancho, and we saw the performance Inferno just last week in Ljubljana, how would you interpret or critically evaluate their use of animals on stage, or what effect does this usage of animals have on stage?
That's a very good question to link to the work of Raffaello Sanzio. As you saw Inferno, I must ask, because I saw this in Avignon, whether a horse is brought to the stage in the play. And as in many other Raffaello Sanzio plays where a horse is brought to the stage, of course the presence of the horse, Robert Walser, the novelist, says, is the presence of a mountain to an actor. It is though the actor, the human actor, is faced with a mountain. Robert Walser said this, I think, at the beginning of the 20th century. It is one of the most intelligent things I ever heard said about an actor. There are not many intelligent things said about actors, but Robert Walser was, I think, very true here. Romeo Castellucci and his group understand that the presence of a non-human animal in a space throws the actor back on their own lesser status. And I will just explain this. The human animal is the lesser animal, the more modest animal, because the human animal is the only animal who can disappoint. No other animal has the potential to disappoint an audience like a human animal. The horse can never disappoint. The horse can only ever be perfect in its own terms, whereas the human animal as an actor is always disappointing, very egotistical. Often in theatres in England we have black and white photographs of actors looking very beautiful. They have had airbrushed face, they have their hair made up in a special way. This is because they are so disappointing in reality that they have to be constructed in this extraordinary way. And I'm very interested, I wrote about this in my book Theatre Intimacy and Engagement, I'm very interested in the way in which the animal throws in the stage the human animal back on their impoverished status, on their disappointing status. And it allows us, and I think Romeo is in a way doing this, to measure the degree of disappointment we have in the human, which is of course a political question, profoundly political. One other thing, for Romeo, of course, the goat was the great tragic animal, and the goat is central to the tragic drama and to the tragic sacrifice. And the goat's breath is the breath of theatre. It is the beginning of tragic theatre. And of course the goat would have played a very special part in the Dionysian ritual which occurred around the production of Oedipus. When Oedipus was first produced, a goat would have been slaughtered at some point as part of a rite or a festival, and that link to the theatricality would have been clear for Greek people, but clear because the goat had been brought from a transhumance, a movement of care in the summer. The goat is looked after in the heat in order to be killed more successfully. So for me this circularity is quite interesting, that tragic drama begins with an image of a goat, and Romeo talks at some length, very difficult and very poetically and almost impossibly to understand, about the relationship between his theatre and the breath of this goat. However that means to us, whatever it means to us, it strikes me as being very interesting that he takes the trouble to recognize and include on the stage other animals. One last point, in Tragedia Endogenidia, in the production in Bergen, one of the performances, of course, famously, Romeo put a very small baby on the stage. It was just old enough to sit up, but not old enough to crawl. It was very near the edge of the stage. It could not fall off because it could not get there. People were very unhappy about the use of this baby in the performance. But in a way, Romeo was treating the baby with the care of the other animals. He was connecting the infant to animals. The infant is without language. The animals are apparently without language. And these figures without language, infants without language, seem to have a quite totemic quality for Romeo's performance work. So I'm sure we go on seeing wherever there is Raffaello Sanzio, we will always see humans and other animals at work.
So you think this is their advantage, children and animals, that they can't act? Actually, this is the advantage.
Yes, precisely. We have a comedian in America, W.C. Fields, who said a very famous thing. I think it was him who said it. He meant in film, not in theatre, but it is good for theatre. Never work with children or animals. And of course, what he meant was, you will never get a professional finish to this work. Thank God. Thank God there will never be a professional finish to a Romeo Castellucci show with animals within it. Because, of course, Romeo's work is engineered to the edge of disaster because of its technical brilliance. It could be absolutely cold. It could be absolutely severe. But the great thing of Romeo's inclusion of animals and infants is we are never sure how they will operate, and therefore they make the piece ultimately human. Perversely, because they are not human, and I include babies in this, they are certainly not human, human as we understand it, adult human of a certain size, not conscious in the way we are, not able to use language, they allow us to get beyond the veneer of the theatre, of the technocratic theatre, to something other than this technocratic perfection, which is always a risk in Romeo's work.
You also mentioned your book, Theatre, Intimacy and Engagement, and the subtitle of it is The Last Human Venue. This sounds a bit apocalyptic. What is it about?
I like very much the way you say a bit apocalyptic, because that is exactly what it is. It is not really that serious about the apocalypse. I am interested in endings, and I'm interested in a time in which we are the first generation, perhaps, that can measure the end. I think every generation from before the time of Oedipus thought that it could measure the end, but we seriously can measure the end. We know it is an inconvenient truth that we can now measure the end of the world from the greenhouse gases, from the global warming. This is something we can do that no other generation, it is now your generation, that has taken the trouble to measure this end. We can measure the end with regard to genocide. We know how many more genocides are possible in the world before we bring the world to a moral end. We can also perhaps consider nuclear proliferation or questions of the measurement and control of such an ending. And for me, this allows us to come back from teleology, from an ending, to a point at which we can measure the distance to such an end and begin to activate the distancing of this end. The reason that the theatre is the last human venue from before the time of Oedipus, let us be clear, I'm not talking about Romeo Castellucci, I'm talking about everything from before Sophocles. The theatre has always been the last human venue because the theatre was the only venue in which an end could be measured. Very, very precisely. And it is the aesthetic act within which that measurement takes place. I'm not here saying that you can measure how long it is until the play ends. That is interesting because it's very difficult to do that until the curtains close. Then I think in the theatre you are always measuring the distance between you as a human, another human on the stage, and the objects that move about the space. You are measuring a set of distances in a very palpable way, which operate ecologically, profoundly ecologically. And therefore, for me, theatre of all the arts was always the ecological art. It did not need Goat Island from Chicago and their work on repair and ecology to tell us this. I love Goat Island, but I don't think they are the only group who worked ecologically. Every theatre group that ever took imagery as their operation, gesture as their operation, has measured distances of this kind. This measurement has taught us to be very clear about such an ending. And in that sense, for me, the theatre will always be the last human venue. One last thing in my book, Theatre, Intimacy and Engagement, The Last Human Venue, is I ask the question, when we become extinct, will performance come and end just before the final moment? This is very important for me to know, just for my own satisfaction. Will performance die at the same moment as extinction of human beings, or will it die just before? And I hope that we suggest, and perhaps this could be discovered in some texts of a Jewish tradition or something, we will discover that indeed performance does end just prior to the end of the world as we know it. It would be very appealing to me to think there was one moment that was de-performance, not performance, where we could be free of performance, restored behavior as we become extinct. That excites me. And however short that moment is, will be a real relief, because of course we are tragically wedded, tragically connected to the idea of performance as a culture.
My last question would be about this project of yours, Abandoned Practices and Endangered Uses. I would like you to present it in short. And my question is, what is the purpose of this collection?
Yes. I begin a project over the next 3 years, and it is called Abandoned Practices and Endangered Uses. Practices are disappearing at a rate at the moment that is faster than at any time in history, because at this stage in history we have a proliferation of practices which allows us to abandon them as though there is no significance to abandoning them. So the question that Isabel Stengers, the historian of chemistry, asks is, how long can we go on abandoning practices and lacking diversity when we need precisely at this moment for the success of science to recognize that the abandonment of practices is to close down opportunities of true knowledge? So my question in my project is this. Perhaps I could invite anybody hearing this to contribute an idea of what their own understanding of an abandoned practice is. And I'm not going to suggest what these are. In our discussion we talked about transhumance, and this in parts of Europe is an abandoned practice. But these range across military, across warfare, across ethics, across medicine, across law, across humanities, across sport. They range across all areas of social practice, and this is why they interest me. The idea for the project is to compile, to put together, to construct an index of abandoned practices. So simply, we make a list of these practices that we are interested in. This is why I'm inviting examples, because to have a list of five things is not very interesting, but to have a list of 5,000 things would be quite interesting, because it would suggest Isabel Stengers is right. There are many of these things that we can think about, and I think she's probably true. Now, the index will be in alphabetical order, like a good index is, and there will be no hierarchy. Because, for instance, we might want to consider that a form of torture, such as water torture, which has been prevalent in Guantanamo Bay and in the Philippines with the American occupation, is something that we want to recognize has been abandoned, and it has been abandoned by the American government, but we don't necessarily want to judge whether this is good or bad. For instance, with voodoo, there are people who are very interested in voodoo. Now, I don't want to presume that voodoo does not have anything to offer. Voodoo might have lots to offer, and it has to go into the index before we consider what it has to offer. The second part of the project, anyone listening to this might wonder, okay, so you get an index of abandoned practices. What do you do with this index? I'm a performance maker, so I'm interested then in working with people on an idea from Giorgio Agamben about profanation. This idea comes from his work on profanation, and it is to turn something sacred, which means separate, back through play into use. So Agamben says, if something is sacred, one way to recover it for use now is to play with it, like a child perhaps, to bring it back into use. Now, because I have a derelict, abandoned museum in London to work in, I thought this was interesting. A museum would be a place where normally the thing in the museum will be abandoned because you cannot touch it. It is in a museum because you cannot use it anymore. It has been put there precisely to stare at. But this museum we create in London, in the old Anatomy Museum on the Strand, will be what we call a movement museum. It'll be a museum of gesture, a place where we will reactivate abandoned practices and explore whether they can be brought back into use through play. Now, somebody listening might say, why would you want to bring water torture back into use in your university through play? That sounds very peculiar. Yes, it is, but it might also allow us to judge what the merits of an abandoned practice are, which might be very important to us. For instance, astrology, phrenology, ethology, certain areas that are in disrepute could perhaps be brought back and reactivated for us to consider the way they could be helpful. Of course, as a performance specialist, my main interest is the way in which abandoned practices already and everywhere are reactivated theatrically. So the example of the transhumance is interesting to me because it is being acted out by people as a restored performance. And I think if people in their sending in of ideas look quite closely, they will discover that many of the things they think are abandoned have been already restored theatrically. So that is, of course, interesting from a straight, quite common, orthodox theatrical perspective.